normal in the field of obstetrics, and this is something, well, not normal, but this is something that can be, these things are time to time.
Did the doctor tell the parents this that you're talking about?
I'm sorry?
Did the doctor tell the parents that this is normal, don't worry about it?
I believe there was testimony to the effect that the indentions were, while not exactly normal, were something that could appear from time to time, and it was expected in the usual course of events that they would resolve themselves in a few days. When it was found that they did not, then was the time for further investigation, and there's no complaint at a later time that the doctors didn't do what was necessary to follow up on this. The last thing, if I may just have a closing word, is that as to Dr. Allen, we've kind of run over the map this morning. We've talked about x-rays, and we've talked about forceps and things that really never came out as to Dr. Allen. Basically, what Dr. Allen was facing was an informed consent case. The question is, why is this an informed consent case? And the answer is because that's the only thing the plaintiff had in his pleadings. He tried to make facts fit the law where they didn't fit. The fact is that informed consent to do what arises in this just like a red herring immediately, because there's no complaint that there any injury ever flowed from the procedure they're talking about. The child's head was repaired, the fractures were repaired a little later, and there was no complaint that there was ever any injury from that procedure. Informed consent talks about a proposed diagnosis. Wilson versus Scott teaches us that we're talking about proposed diagnoses by its very nature. You can't give informed consent about a possible procedure that hasn't been proposed, that hasn't been talked about, that the doctor isn't thinking about. If that's the kind of case you're talking about, then you're talking about something besides informed consent. Perhaps negligent treatment. Perhaps failure to refer the infant for surgery. But that, again, that was a theory that was fled and never followed up upon. It would seem to me that in this kind of case, what we've got is we've got a situation where the question is what should be disclosed to the witness, and the doctor tells the circumstances under which the possibility of the fracture should be disclosed, and then the jury second-guessing on that. To do that is to let those who know what should be done in the course of their scope and their field of training, those persons who have that training are judged by those who do not. And I think that's a violation of the tenets that Wilson versus Scott teaches us, and also undermines the very rationale for having expert testimony in the first place. If there's anything further, I'll be glad to try to answer, Your Honor. Otherwise, I look forward to speaking with you on rebuttal.
Rebuttal argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Kevin J. Keith will present argument for Dr. Matthews.
May it please the court, I would first like to clear up some confusion that obviously was created by the respondent's brief in this case. The first part of that brief urged that the trial amendment that this court is considering was not in the appellate record. The reason that that confusion was created was that the petitioner filed a supplemental transcript that contained the trial amendment with the Court of Appeals without giving either Dr. Allen or this counsel notice of that filing. Apparently 2 weeks after that filing, the petitioner then moved for leave to file that supplemental transcript, to which both defendants responded, and there was never any ruling on those motions. So at the time I prepared the brief, I was unaware until this past Monday that the trial amendment was before the court. I just point that out to the court. I was not trying to mislead you, and that that part of my argument should be disregarded, that the trial amendment is in the record, and we can argue the merits of it. I represent Dr. Matthews. The petitioner's application for writ of error was granted as to Dr. Matthews on the point that the Court of Appeals erred in finding that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying the trial amendment offered at trial by the plaintiff, Roark. Petitioner's third point of error argues that it was an abuse of the trial court's discretion to refuse to allow the filing of that trial amendment for three reasons. The first reason being that the original petition of the plaintiff generally alleged the negligent use of forceps, and that neither defendant specially accepted to that original petition. They also argued that the trial amendment should have been allowed because the case and that issue was tried by consent. And finally, the petitioner argues a general argument that the trial amendment should have been allowed in the interest of justice. I'll take each of those arguments individually. The first argument, that the trial court abused its discretion in denying the trial amendment for the reason that the original petition contained general allegations of a negligent use of forceps, which was not accepted to, is not a proper argument to support the failure to allow the filing of a trial amendment. If a pleading, an active pleading, was already on file containing general allegations of negligence, a trial amendment is not necessary. So we need to first look at the plaintiff's original petition, as the Court of Appeals did, as a reasonably prudent defense attorney trying to determine what issues this case was going to be tried on, and determine whether or not, first of all, whether the plaintiff's original petition did allege a cause of action of negligence and proximate cause regarding Dr. Matthews' alleged negligent use of the forceps. That original petition has been read to you, but I don't wish to belabor the matter, but it is the only way that we can determine this, and I would like to give you Dr. Matthews and his counsel's point of view on the import of that pleading. In the second paragraph of plaintiff's original petition, he alleges the facts upon which this cause of action was based. Midway down, as has been read to you, it states that following this attempted delivery, Dr. Allen obtained the consultation of Dr. J.G. Matthews, and according to the information furnished to plaintiffs, Dr. Matthews effected the delivery of the child without difficulty to the child's head by use of forceps, goes on to record the time of the delivery. This was their original petition. This was the petition that they went to trial on after all the pretrial discovery was in. And when the plaintiffs stated that based on all the information they had been furnished that they went to trial on, there was no negligence or there was no difficulty in the use of those forceps to the child said by Dr. Matthews. Not only is this not a general allegation of negligence as to Dr. Matthews' negligent use of the forceps, but I think it imports just the opposite. It is very misleading. That is the only reference to use of the forceps in the petition. And in our opinion, it states that there was no negligence and that was not an issue that was going to be tried. The next paragraph that the petitioner relies very heavily on states, as a result of the delivery or attempts at delivery by the defendants, jointly and severally, the infant sustained bilateral depressed skull fractures, with the left side of the head being more depressed, extensively depressed, than the right side. This was something that was conceded during pretrial discovery. It was something that Dr. Matthews testified to, that without a doubt in his mind, the fractures occurred during the delivery, during the childbirth. He did not, as opposed to what petitioner stated, ever concede that it was his negligent use of forceps that caused the fracture.
What else? Your Honor, what else could have caused it?
There are several non-negligent uses that could have created the fractures. First of all, the defectiveness of the forceps. That possibly could have been a defense in this action. There's testimony that the forceps came apart, and Dr. Matthews also testified that there was an unusual degree of flexibility in these forceps that could have caused the fracture. He said that he used those forceps in the usual manner that he ordinarily does, and that when the child's head finally did pop out of the mother, there were indentations on the soft tissue of the skull, and that because of the extraordinary method of this type of delivery, that is not uncommon at all. There was also testimony by Dr. Allen in this case that even if the best medical care is used, fractures of this type do occur in this type of delivery. The choice here was whether or not to do a cesarean section or to do this type of procedure with forceps that involves reaching up into the mother's womb, grabbing onto the bony skull portion of the head, and using a great deal of leverage, bringing the child out in a breech birth. Even without negligence, a fracture of this type can occur, and that was the evidence in the record. But the primary question is whether or not the plaintiff had a pleading on file that said we were negligent in the use of the forceps, and I contend that the plaintiff's original petition states just the opposite.
Counsel, right following what you read, goes on to say, as a result of the delivery or attempts at delivery by the defendants, jointly and severally, the infant sustained bilateral depressed skull fractures. How do you...
Okay, that is exactly what Dr. Matthews testified to at trial, and that was his testimony during pretrial discovery, that during the delivery of this child, the skull sustained a fracture. That is quite a long ways away from saying that his negligent use of forceps caused the skull to sustain a fracture. There also was no allegation there of proximate cause, that the negligent use of the forceps as opposed to any other cause was the proximate cause of the fracture to the skull. If you continue reading plaintiff's original petition and read what you've just read, Your Honor, in context with the next paragraph, after pleading the facts that they were supporting this cause of action on, the plaintiff then specifically alleged two counts of negligence. One, that we failed to obtain the informed consent of the parents, and then failed to refer the infant for surgery. I disagree with the petitioner's characterization of this case, but the whole case involved the negligent use of the forceps. What the entire case, at least a great significant part of the case involved, was, okay, there was a fracture during the childbirth. Why wasn't the child referred for surgery until a month after the fracture occurred? I contend that the plaintiff's original petition does not allege that the fracture occurred by reason of negligence, but once the fracture occurred, why wasn't it discovered? Or, in fact, it doesn't even state that it was negligent not to take x-rays and not to discover it sooner. It just says that the doctors were negligent in not referring the child to another surgeon soon enough. If you find that the plaintiff's original petition does not contain general allegations of negligence, which of course should not be accepted to, when the statement that as a result of the delivery or attempts at delivery, the infant sustained bilateral fractures, that's a fact and it's an undisputed fact going into this trial. How could we have specially accepted to it and asked them to plead more fully a fact that we were not disputing? That was an allegation of fact and not an allegation of a cause of action. There's no statement in there that the doctors were joint and severally negligent. It just says that they joint and severally were involved in the delivery of the child. The next question is whether or not the issue of negligent use of the forceps was tried by consent. Part of the petitioner's argument goes to the fact that no objections were made until Dr. Allen's testimony on the use of the forceps. The fact of the childbirth, the fact that forceps were used, the difficulty that was encountered during this delivery, all were relevant background facts to which the plaintiff Rourke testified at trial. We did not object to his testimony at that time, which we could have on the basis that it was non-probative, that he was not qualified to testify as to whether or not the procedure was within the applicable standard of care. He described it as using it as a crowbar. There's nowhere in the record of a standard of care of whether or not that type of leverage or that particular type of use of the forceps was not within the applicable standard of care. Mr. Rourke was a layman who was viewing a very shocking type of delivery or procedure. He was obviously upset by it, and his testimony reflects that. It would have been prejudicial to the defendants to have continually jumped up and down saying that we don't want the jury to hear anything about the delivery or anything about the childbirth or the difficulty encountered there, because I think the jury is entitled to know some of the background facts that led to the negligent or the allegation that there was negligence after the fracture occurred in not referring the child for surgery at that point in time. Also, I think that the trial court may have allowed that type of testimony to come in to fully inform the jury of what occurred here and what are the issues involved as to the failure to refer the child for surgery after the fractures were sustained during the delivery. When Dr. Allen testified, he was the first witness called who had any possibility of bringing before the jury a standard of care. He was a generalist in this area. It was possible that he could testify as to the applicable standard of care. It was during his testimony that both defendants objected that there were no pleadings to support the area of law that the plaintiff was trying to get into. The trial court at that time stated that the case was not being tried by consent, overruled the objection, and allowed the defendants to maintain a running objection to that. Dr. Allen went further and testified that there was no breach of the standard of care, that even using under the best medical care, these type of fractures do occur, and that based on all of the deliveries that he has witnessed, Dr. Matthews properly used the forceps during the delivery. This goes in part to our argument that even should this court find that there was a general allegation in the plaintiff's original petition of negligent use, or that this case was tried by consent, or that the trial court abused its discretion in denying the trial amendment, you still have a situation where there is no evidence in the record to support the submission of the issues. And these were two points of error that Dr. Matthews argued to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals did not reach the question of no evidence of a standard of care or proximate cause because they found that there just were no pleadings to support the issues, and therefore they didn't need to look further to see if there were any evidence to support the allegations in the pleadings that did not exist. Dr. Matthews did not establish the standard of care through his own testimony. His testimony that he operated used the forceps in a usual manner goes just to the contrary of stating a standard of care that he violated. And I don't think that his testimony can be read or interpreted as establishing a standard of care for this type of procedure. Obviously, the plaintiff Rourke has no knowledge of that, and Dr. Allen's testimony does not support or establish a standard of care for this type of procedure. And a trial amendment, it is not an abuse of a trial amendment. It is not an abuse to deny the filing of a trial amendment if there is no evidence in the record to support it. On that ground...
Counsel, why would the court submit issues on it if there was no evidence?
Your Honor, when I read this record, that was exactly the question that I asked the attorney that handled the trial of this case. I said the trial court stated that it was not to be tried by consent. He then denied the trial amendment. Why on earth did he submit special issues on it and allow the jury to, based on the crowbar testimony of the plaintiff, find negligence of Dr. Matthews on that question? Jim Williams of our firm, who did try the case, stated that Mr. Holloway just flat out talked the judge into it based on the fact that this fellow had traveled down from Vancouver and based essentially on the fact that there were general allegations in the plaintiff's original petition. Judge Ashworth is a very competent trial judge, but he is not often applauded for his preparation of the charge. And we've made that clear to him, and I have no reservation in pointing that out to you, because I think it contributed with Mr. Holloway's persuasiveness to submit issues that there were no pleadings on and no evidence on. And the jury, after hearing all the inflammatory evidence from the plaintiff as to the shocking nature of this delivery, found against Dr. Matthews. This court has stated in Harkey versus Texas Employers that issues are not tried by consent merely by the hearing of testimony, and that the submission of those issues is necessarily a part of that process of trying cases by consent. We objected not only at the evidentiary stage of the case, we objected to the submission of those issues on the specific basis that there were no pleadings to support it. Also on the issue of the trial amendment, I know my time is up. I need to move along. This case set out guidelines for trial courts to determine whether or not a trial amendment should be accepted or not. That case is Westinghouse Electric. The factors that the court has asked the district courts to look at is whether or not the defendants had a right to assume, based on the pleadings, what issues were to be tried and what areas they were to prepare a defense on. I think this trial amendment, standing on its own merits, assuming that there were no earlier allegations, changed the entire factual context of this case from one being of informed consent and failure to refer the child for surgery after the fracture to one backing up and saying, no, you were negligent during the delivery and in the use of the forceps. The fact that the trial amendment was not made until after the close of all the evidence denied us the right to prepare a defense to that. This court has also held under Rule 63, which pertains to the admissibility or the amending of pleadings prior to trial, that once a trial court denies a trial amendment, the burden is not on the burden is on the party complaining of the denial that it was an abuse of discretion, and that the other party does not at the subsequent time need to come in and show surprise or prejudice or that type of thing. I think surprise and prejudice are reflected on the face of this record based on the timing and the change of the entire factual context of the case.
I take it you had objections to the submission of the issues that we're talking about.
Yes, Your Honor. Vehement objections to them. The policy reasons stated in the Westinghouse case to deny this type of 11th hour amendment of pleadings, stated by the court, is that it disrupts the orderly procedure, that it's very costly, and that it would open the door to fraud. Now, I'm not stating that Mr. Holloway pled that we were not negligent in the use of forceps, then specifically pled two specific acts of negligence, thinking that sometime during trial he would then allege negligent use of the forceps. But I think the court can understand that if a trial amendment cannot be denied on these grounds, that would encourage plaintiffs to plead one cause of action, to go to trial on that cause of action, and then to, after all the evidence is in and after there was no opportunity for the defendant to prepare a defense, to then allege an entirely new cause of action, which is what occurred here. I ask the court to affirm the Court of Appeals judgment that there was no abuse of discretion in the denial by the trial court of this trial amendment, and to tax the costs against the petitioner, Roard.
Thank you, counsel. Of course, you take a brief recess.
The audience, please rise.
Court, please. I want to make only one statement in rebuttal to Dr. Matthews' argument. That is that the law is settled by Supreme Court in the Caner versus Walker case cited brief. When a plea of negligence exists in general terms and not accepted to, it's sufficient to warrant submission of issues either generally or in groups of special issues. Every defect, omission, generality, or other insufficiencies is waived unless accepted to. That's Rule 90, Rule 47.
Counsel, in Scott versus Atchison, Topeka and Santa Fe, they tried the case and admitted a tremendous amount of unpleaded material. The only protective step that the defendant railroad took was to object to the charge. We reversed that case, said that the case was not tried by consent because there was an objection to the charge.
Yes, and in that particular case, if I recall, Your Honor, the party did not offer a trial amendment in the case.
I believe you're right about that.
Which, in my opinion, distinguishes this particular case. But let me go to something, Your Honor. This may be my last opportunity to be before this honorable court on informed consent issue.
Okay, you got another name for it?
Yes, sir. I'm going to give you another name for it.
All right.
That name is, quote, patients' rights, close quote. Let me suggest to you that there's a recent case that's rather novel. It's by the Waco Appellate Court. It's the 75 Rosenthal versus Bloom, where a automobile accident claimant says that he was not furnished information about his injury, and that he settled, and he then sued the doctor for $261,000, saying, well, if you hadn't told me I was all right, I would have done other things with the settlement. The court said most jurisdictions, and particularly the more modern decisions, use the words that a cause of action for negligent misrepresentation. And they pick up from restatement of torts, information negligently supplied for the guidance of others. It talks about a person who, in the course of his business, profession, or employment, gives out information. And it goes on to say, if he fails to exercise reasonable care or competence in obtaining the necessary information. Now, looking back to another aspect, in the case of Lloyd versus Ray by the San Antonio 1980 decision 606-545, it talked about a patient bringing a suit for negligence in not locating an IUD device. It has this to say, the failure to discover the device, or if he discovered it, the failure to inform appellant of the fact. The doctor's failure to diagnose and inform is as actionable as if he acted affirmatively to produce an injury. Your Honor, Wilson v. Scott is still cited in most informed consent cases. I specifically have a thorn in my side over a case of Gaunt v. Quash, which this court did by per curiam opinion, where a doctor fraudulently told a man that he had cancer of the stomach. They operated on him and his stomach was clean. And he admitted during the trial that he probably misrepresented the facts to the man, but that he thought he ought to have the surgery anyway, and the man ought to be happy he didn't have cancer. In that case, the Supreme Court, on a per curiam opinion, basically said that fraudulent acts to gain consent can be covered by the mere submission of informed consent. I'm going to give you three cases. I've looked, for 2 days, I've looked at something that I could say this court from Texas law, and I can't find it. There's a case of, in California, these are all Supreme Court cases, and I've cited in the briefs, and I'll write a letter so that counsel will have them with permission of the court. One is 611 Pacific 2nd 902, 1980, in-bank hearing. They say that the scope of the physician's duty is measured by the amount of knowledge a patient needs to make an informed choice. Now, in this case, we're talking about the parent electing what to do with this child if he had fractures. The fractures needed repair because as long as there, they were a potential a problem. Fortunately, the child didn't have those real problems.
Well, counsel, there's no duty on the part of the doctor to disclose information which he doesn't know, is there?
Oh, yes, sir. It's that which he knew or should know by the exercise of ordinary care, and that's the standard. Very simple. The doctor merely says, I didn't know that, so I didn't tell him. That's what this particular case that I cite to you mentions. It's what he knew or should know. Now, listen to what informed consent really is. Godarza said it's the right of every person to predetermine what's to be done with his body medically. It includes not only what risk you take to get treatment, but it also includes, more importantly, the risk that you undertake if you don't get treatment. So it's a two-edged sword. There's a The Supreme Court of the State of Washington in 1980, again an en banc hearing, 622 Pacific 1246, talks about this duty. They say this: whenever the doctor becomes aware of any risk or danger, the duty to disclose exists, because it's more than just a fiduciary, it's a position of trust and confidence. It says, once it has been established by expert testimony that a risk exists, the existence of the risk is the patient's business and is not for the medical profession to establish a criteria for the dissemination of information about what doctors feel a patient has a right to know. The duty to disclose arises as to each and every item of information that the doctor knows or should know about the patient's physical condition. And it says this: to bind the disclosure obligation to medical uses is to abrogate the decision on revelation to the physician alone. Respect for the patient's right of self-determination demands a standard set by law for physicians, rather than the physicians setting the standards themselves upon which they want to be governed in malpractice litigation.
Counsel, I think our only concern is that some of us maybe don't see why it's essential to a cause of action against a doctor to squeeze it into the mold or the phrase informed consent. There are many duties that a doctor may owe outside of that mold. In other words, it's not essential to this plaintiff or any plaintiff's recovery to squeeze it into that limited mold of informed consent if there is a duty, such as those cases you're talking about. And I don't understand why you're insisting that this has to be informed consent.
Judge, I'm not, except that that's the way it went to the jury. Judge, both my request to this court in trying a number of informed consent is that this court straighten it out. It's not a question, basically, as you said, of pinning a tag and saying informed consent is a standard to be determined by expert testimony. Because it's not. If you go back and say it's the right of the patient to know.
Well, we've already said that.
Right. Then you don't need you don't need the question of informed consent. You need merely the duty to tell. And I don't know what you're going to, other than say the right of the patient. I've never seen a doctor yet who's ever suffered an injury by not telling a patient what he should know, except to get sued. That's his only injury he ever suffers. They don't get hurt in surgery when they operate on them, and they don't get hurt either. Now, I think that if you approach it from this standpoint, that you're talking about a decision to be made by a person and not by the medical profession, and suggest that that's one way to approach it. What that patient
counsel,
or the parent is right
inspired.
Now. Thank you.
Your further arguments are in your brother.
Thank you.
May we be excused, Judge?
No. Please sit down.
Sorry.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I have one or two points to address. At the outset, Mr. Holloway said it's a game. It's not a game. It's very important to Dr. Allen that he be judged according to standards of care that are established in the evidence. Otherwise, we have trial by speculation and guesswork. And that's basically what I think we've been hearing on rebuttal by counsel, proposing new types of causes of action and ignoring the need for a standard of care and even in some of those. What if this court were to consider a new cause of action for negligent misrepresentation, which I think goes beyond the pleadings and the evidence in this case? We're really getting beyond the bounds. But what if we were to consider that? Presumably, there would have to be a standard of care. There always has been in professional liability cases. It's a safeguard to see that those who are highly trained in professions will know that they are being judged according to some standards that are established in the evidence
and that jurors of average intelligence and ordinary background and knowledge can be guided by. Otherwise, we're relegated to speculation.
When I count for that, if the doctor says to the parents of this child, oh, don't worry about those indentations, that's nothing. We see those every once in a while, and nothing ever comes of it. Now, hasn't he made a positive representation that don't worry about it, it's going to be okay, and isn't that a negligent misrepresentation for which he is liable?
Your Honor, I think the question there would be, what should the doctor tell his patients? And back when this court wrote Wilson v. Scott, it recognized and even said that the nature and the extent of the disclosure to the patient is something that calls for medical judgment.
Are there issues on negligent misrepresentation?
No, Your Honor. This is something that's gone entirely beyond the pleadings, and I hope the court appreciates that. Really, the way the case was framed by plaintiff's own doing is what they said, that this is an informed consent case, or if negligence in failing to refer the infant for surgery. For whatever reasons, that second theory was never pursued. No evidence was developed, no issues were submitted. That relegated the plaintiffs to only an informed consent theory, and that problem of trying to fit a case into a theory which doesn't fit the facts. I beg your pardon?
The trial amendment covered?
Only to the extent that the attempt was to bring up the business of using the forceps at a later time, Your Honor. Now, the attempt there, once again, was to bring into the case a new element that was new to all the parties involved, that were given knowledge by the pleadings that we're going to claim informed consent or failure to refer the infant, and we're also going to state in our pleadings that we're not saying that anything was wrong with the way the forceps were used. At a later time, we're going to say we want to bring forceps into the case. Once again, the issue was objected to. The question was objected to every time a doctor was asked to state something about the standard of care, and the court ruled on every occasion. I think it came up three very significant places in the testimony and statement of facts, and the court said, we'll give Mr. Holloway wide latitude in answering or asking the questions he needs to prove his informed consent case, but we will not try issues by consent. And once again, the issues were objected to at a later time when the case was submitted. So there hadn't been any waiver anywhere on that regard. And what it relegates the plaintiffs to is an informed consent theory, which really doesn't fit the facts here. Finally, I think we see from looking at Wilson v. Scott is that the idea of a menu approach, that is, go down the list of every possible risk, every possible thing that a patient should know about a given procedure, and scare the heck out of that patient, if you will. That's not the way the doctors do their practice, if they can, because it's not the policy of doctors to scare their patients out of surgery or to unduly alarm them about risks that are not all that great. Wilson v. Scott recognized that when the court wrote that in some medical procedures, the dangers are great, in others, they're minimal. The question of what to reveal, when to reveal it, is a question of medical judgment. And the question of what standard of care the doctor should abide by is a question that calls for expert evidence, never presented in this case beyond the extent we've discussed here this morning. With that, Your Honor, I'll conclude and invite any other questions the court may have. We would respectfully ask that to the extent that the Court of Appeals has rendered judgment against Dr. Allen, that portion of the judgment be reversed and rendered in favor of Dr. Allen.
Thank you, Counsel. It became evident during the argument that counsel for both sides would like to submit post-submission briefs, and that's the reason, counsel, I asked you to remain so that whatever was said, you could include it in your reply brief.
Your Honor, I apologize for asking you to be excused. I've forgotten that there was another response.
All right. All right. Would a week be sufficient time for both of you to submit the additional authorities, if you have any? All right, thank you. Now you'll be excused. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is pleased that the students from Lubbock High School, the class in government, is visiting with us. You're welcome.